A lot of your early acting work was given to you because people were kind of hoping you would build the sets. Like they were like, if we cast him in a small part, at least we'll have him, you know, he'll be here. He can fix stuff because he's handy.
Yeah, that was a pretty, it was a pretty openly accepted arrangement. I was aware that I was not quite up to snuff in the talent department yet, and so I was happy to build the set in exchange for three lines.
So tell me a bit about Somebody Up There Likes Me.
Somebody Up There Likes Me is a really interesting, sweet little comedy. It's a bit of a cautionary tale about how we modern Americans all have a disaffected teenager within us. You know, we're so comfortable in this day and age that if we're not careful, we can allow all the big events in our lives to pass us by while we're too busy paying attention to the small events.
This was, I think, one of the first times, other than maybe Deadwood, where I've seen you and been like, oh, right, Nick Offerman isn't Ron Swanson. Like, to have that kind of dissociation between you and that character. Do you think sometimes that maybe, you know, there are certainly positives and negatives to being really, really tied to one character. Do you kind of have that reaction from people sometimes? Like, they expect you to be Ron Swanson if they meet you in person?
Sure, yeah. I like to remind them that Ron Swanson is delicious to them in 2-minute increments per week. And I think if you ever had 90 minutes of him, he'd be exceedingly boring. You know, he would probably actually cane a chair seat and think it was the most wonderful thing in the world. And you'd think it was funny for about 30 seconds, and then you'd realize, oh, he's really going to cane a chair for 90 minutes.
So you're saying the Ron Swanson movie, which I'm sure there are a lot of people out there who'd probably want to see that, but you think the Ron Swanson movie would be just like hollowing out a canoe or something?
Yeah, or literally, you know, a 90-minute treatise on chopping firewood. and the thing is that's funny. That's a piece of humor to say the Ron Swanson movie would be a 90-minute treatise of chopping firewood. But to actually experience it would not be as funny as simply stating it. And that's what I just try to remind people is, people would be like, oh, that's amazing. I'm going to bring whiskey and bacon and watch it. And I think 5 minutes into it, you'd be like, are you really just going to keep swinging that axe? Jesus.
Do you have a favorite Ron Swanson line?
Boy, there's sure a lot of them I'm fond of. But one of our writers named Dan Gore wrote a line where Ron says, they're in a bowling alley, and he says to Anne, this bowling alley has my favorite restaurant. And he looks over, and it's a little stand that says hamburger and hot dog. And she says, aren't you scared to eat there? And he says, when I eat, it is the food that is scared. I'm pleasantly surprised that anything I'm involved in has had that kind of popularity, but I think it's just a testament to our writing staff. When I consider it in those terms, then I'm not surprised, because I'm so grateful to have landed in this playroom with a group of people that are interested, but in dealing in comedy that has heart and fairness, and I really love being part of a show that's not cynical or mean or has a negative point of view, but instead deals in optimism. That really means a lot to me.
Something I kind of really love about Ron and about the whole show, it kind of seems like the whole show has just been about this curmudgeonly guy who really feels like a lone wolf or an individual, kind of being slowly worn down and kind of slowly warming up to the idea of, you know, community and government and friendship, I guess, over the course of the series.
You know, I think it's more like a big gnarly onion, always has those layers to it, but we're just slowly peeling them back season by season. I think Ron was initially intended to be more of an antagonist, and once they saw the chemistry between Ron and Leslie, the show creators said, oh, there's I think, much more to be mined here.
I've spoken to a number of comedians in the last few years who've mentioned having furniture that you have made. Is it possible to just buy furniture from you, or is that something that you kind of just do on, like, a friendship basis?
Well, it used to be more possible before I got this dreamy job on Parks and Rec. I still have a very burgeoning furniture concern at offermanwoodshop.com, and I have four or five young woodworkers under me building commissions that come in. My own time in the shop has become incredibly limited, so these days I kind of oversee everyone's work. Rarely am able to get my hands dirty. I was in there this morning for a couple hours, and we went over the week's work, and we have a canoe that one of our young ladies is finishing up for a client, and I'm getting ready to make a batch of ukuleles with one of our young guys who recently created a kazoo for the shop. I've turned it into a bit of a co-op, and so people can still get articles from my shop, just not with a lot of handwork on them from me personally.
What are you building ukuleles for?
Well, that's a silly question. I mean, in short, for joy. To engender mirth.
I didn't know if there was, like, a specific reason if you were going to start a ukulele orchestra or something. Okay.
No, I'm actually driving towards building acoustic guitars, and I thought making some ukuleles would be a good first step towards that effort.
I love that you've kept that up. Is it kind of a therapeutic thing for you when you're not doing acting?
It is very much. It keeps me attached to my family and the feeling of, I've been a laborer all my life, and I don't want to lose that work ethic. I think that having the ability to perform work that one loves is a great privilege. There's so many people who hate their job. And I'm lucky enough to get paid to do what I love, and so whenever I have the opportunity, I love to continue being a student of that craft, and that involves sharing it with others and opening my shop to other woodworkers. I love that Parks and Rec has allowed me to four or five other young woodworkers on their feet. It's you know, I hope to spread a wave of artisanry, of hand craftsmanship across the nation. I would like to see a return to a more Jeffersonian ideal in that regard.
Nick Offerman, thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate you taking all this time.
Oh, my pleasure. I'd much rather talk to Champagne than New York any day of the week.
Ah, that's real sweet. Thank you. The fifth season of Parks and Recreation had its finale last night, and his new film, Somebody Up There Likes Me, is available on VOD and is rolling out in theaters across America as we speak. I'm Chris Berube. You're listening to WILL Radio.
WILL programming is made possible by Champaign-Urbana Ballet, presenting its stylishly magical production of Prokofiev's Cinderella in four performances May 3rd through 5th in the newly renovated Virginia Theater in downtown Champaign. Tickets available at 356-9063 or at thevirginia.org.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday, the 3rd of May, 2013. It's the birthday of the man who wrote, "A prince never lacks legitimate reasons to break his promise." Niccolo Machiavelli, born in Florence, 1469. At a time when Italy was not a unified country, it was a collection of city-states, a time of instability, Machiavelli lost his job when the city government of Florence was overthrown by the Medici family, and he wrote his book, The Prince, in 1513, as an instruction manual on obtaining and holding on to power. in hopes that he could impress the Medicis and get a job with them. He wrote that morality was irrelevant when it came to running a state, that rulers should be willing to do evil when necessary to hold on to power and maintain security. It's the birthday of the photographer and social reformer Jacob Riis, born in Ribe, Denmark, 1849, whose flash photographs of living conditions in the slums of New York helped bring about housing reforms. It's the birthday of the Israeli poet and novelist Yehuda Amichai, born Ludwig Pfeffer in Würzburg, Germany, 1924, moved to Palestine, became an Israeli citizen, and was one of the first poets to write in colloquial Hebrew. Here's a poem for today by Faith Sheeran, entitled Smoke. It was everywhere in my childhood, in restaurants, on buses or planes. The teacher's lounge looked like London under fog. My grandmother never stopped smoking, and walking in her house was like diving in a dark pond. Adults were dimly lit. They carried matches in their pockets as if they might need fire to see. Cigarette machines inhaled quarters and exhaled rectangles. Women had their own brands, long and thin. One was named Eve, and it was meant to be smoked in a garden thick with summer flowers. I'm speaking of Moods, an old country store where my grandfather met friends and everyone spoke behind a veil of smoke. My Uncle Bill preferred fragrant cigars. I can still smell his postal jacket. He had time to tell stories because he took breaks, and there was something to do with his hands. My mother's bridge club gathered around tables with ashtrays and secrets which are best revealed beside fire. Even the fireplaces are gone, inefficient and messy. We are healthier now and safer. We have exercise and tests for breast or colon cancer. We have helmets and car seats and smokeless coffee shops where coffee has grown frothy and complex. The old movies are so full of smoke that actors are hard to see, and they're often wrapped in smoking jackets, bent over a piano or kiss. I miss the places smoke created. I like the way people sat down for rest or pleasure and spoke to other people, not phones, and the tiny fire, which is crimson and primitive and warm. How long ago, when humans found this spark of warmth and made their first circle? What about smoke?